The rise of the West, a lot of historical evidence now that it was really predicated on Christianity, or Christianity, Christian morals played a huge role in that. And now we're going to try and say, we're going to have the advanced West, but we're not going to do Christianity anymore. And again, it may be that we've just reached a level of technological development, for example, where we're going to be fine and it's not going to matter, but I do think it's a little bit of a risk.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today I'm joined by James Kerestede. James studied classics at Oxford and ancient history at the University of London and holds a PhD in classics from Stanford. James co-hosts Free Kiwis, a podcast dedicated to free speech in New Zealand, and previously was a research fellow with the New Zealand Initiative, focusing on higher education policy, including academic freedom. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. That was a very nice intro. I haven't actually prepared a very nice intro about you, but it's very nice to be here with you in Kamakura.
Yeah, no, thank you. You've just left New Zealand after 12 years.
I have.
Tell me, how does that feel?
It feels a little bit sad, to be honest, because obviously it was my home for 12 years and made a lot of friends there, a lot of contacts, did a lot of things there, both in academia and in the think tank world. But also feels like the right time to move on, and it's a big world out there, and I'm, you know, becoming reacquainted with this fact here in Japan, which is a much bigger world than New Zealand.
Yeah. New Zealand is perhaps as far away from Europe as you can get. And a lot of your work in classics in particular has been exploring this idea of the Latin and Greek tradition and its impacts on certainly the world we are in today. And I just wonder, how did you feel about this experience, 12 years in New Zealand at the bottom of the world? What did that mean for your understanding of, I guess, the place of New Zealand in the world and how that kind of connects with your background with classical studies?
Okay, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I started doing classics when I was in England. So I was born in Canada, I went to England when I was 12, and I thought of classics for a long time as a very English thing because I went to a certain type of old-fashioned British boarding school and they emphasized Latin and Greek. So I thought, okay, classics is kind of an English thing to do. I mean, I liked it for mostly for other reasons, but I had that view of it. And then maybe secondarily is a European thing to do. And then I was looking around for postgraduate opportunities, or grad school, as they say in North America, and I went to Stanford, which is in California. And that at the time seemed like going to the fringes of the classics world, even though I now look back and think Stanford was a very big classics department by most standards. It had about 20 or 30 full-time classicists, which is actually huge. It's not as big as Oxford. At Oxford, there's something like 100 full-time classicists. But at the time, it seemed like, you know, on the edges of the classics world, and it also seemed like, you know, a weird thing to do. I didn't associate classics with California. You know, when I thought of California, I thought of people going surfing and the Beach Boys, and, you know, maybe Northern California has nice pine trees or whatever. Pine trees? No, I'm getting that wrong.
Oh, the redwoods.
Redwoods, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. See, I can't even remember. But anyway, I wasn't thinking of classics. So when I was there, a lot of people were thinking along the same lines. Other European classicists who'd come over there, we were sort of thinking, well, what does classics mean in this context? How do we justify it to people? How do we kind of get people to want to take these classes ultimately? Which is a big problem in modern academia. All the humanists are trying to scramble to figure out reasons why people should take their courses. So, you know, you had to start thinking about what is classics? What's the West? Is classics the West? You know, all those questions. And then I moved to New Zealand, and funnily enough, to get my first academic job, in fact, maybe my last academic job, the only academic job I've had so far. And and initially when I went back to New Zealand, it was kind of like returning to the English classics world. Very interestingly, a lot of the stuff in New Zealand, a lot of culture in New Zealand is kind of derivative of British culture. That was my impression anyway. And the classics culture seemed a little bit more old-fashioned, more emphasis on language and literature than at Stanford, which was a lot more into sort of big history, big picture ancient history. So it's become unfashionable nowadays to view classics as the study of the foundations of Western civilization. But I actually think that ultimately is the best justification, not only because it's the one that's going to work best, but also because it's grounded in truth. And so I won't go into it too much depth now unless you ask another question about it, but I'll just say that I think it is the case that even though California, England, and New Zealand are very different places, that they're all Western, and that most travelers to these places recognize them intuitively as Western in terms of the languages they speak, the most popular religion, the sports they play, things like that. Things that are almost too obvious for sort of advanced intellectuals at universities to recognize. And because of that, if we're in a country like New Zealand, it still makes sense to study Greco-Roman antiquity because it is the foundation of that society, or, you know, the most important element, the most dominant element in that society. And so in order to understand ourselves, we still need to study the classics. That doesn't mean that in California, in New Zealand, even in England, there aren't other interesting cultural traditions. In New Zealand, of course, the Maori cultural tradition, the Polynesian tradition is also very interesting. But if we want to study the Western tradition, then you need to study the Greeks and the Romans.
So you previously taught classics at Victoria University of Wellington, and you wrote on your Substack an article, Classics and the New Research on the West.
Yeah.
And I guess, what does this mean? I mean, you had this background with classics, yet we come to New Zealand, a place which, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I grew up there. It feels very far away from any kind of intellectual tradition. It's a very practical place. And I mean, have you reflected on maybe what that means for the way New Zealand culture is going, or where it's going? Is it sort of a case of losing a connection to that great past, that great tradition? Or are we forging a new kind of identity coming out of that? I mean, how do you sort of bundle that all up together? What is your high-level take?
Yeah, it's interesting. I definitely agree with you that New Zealand is like Canada. It's not an intellectual culture. It's a culture that's really into pragmatism, humility, which often doesn't gel well with sort of highfalutin high culture. Nonetheless, every culture has sort of implicit assumptions. I mean, this is one of the things the postmodernists are always trying to remind us of, actually correctly in some ways. And Canadian culture and New Zealand culture, even though they seem to us kind of bland and unhistorical and have no historical depth, they actually do have a lot of historical depth. And people in New Zealand and Canada do things that seem normal to us, but are actually very weird in terms of global cultural history. So that term weird, I mean, I was using that in the sense of the normal English word, but you could also use it in all caps, right? And that's the acronym Western Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic that Joseph Henrich has been using for Western societies. And so if you look, for example, at something Henrich has stressed, Western family structure, the way we look at our ancestry in terms of the father's line and the mother's line at the same time, the way that people get married and move to a new location, the way we don't marry our first cousins, or we think of that as slightly strange. We tend not to marry the siblings of our deceased spouses. All of these cultural mores, which we take for granted and see as normal, they actually come from the past, and they come from actually the deep past. They come from Christianity, and some of them, especially the stress on monogamy, come from earlier antiquity, so especially classical Athens.
So this is The Weirdest People in the World, Joseph Henrich. And in the book, Henrich explores how institutions and psychology jointly influence each other over time. More specifically, he argues that the Christian tradition and the Catholic Church's edicts on marriage that began around the 4th century undermined the foundation of kin-based society and created a more analytical, individualist society that we see present, sort of the nuclear family, I guess. And as you also mentioned, some of the limitations on the way families and marriages can work, a lot of that came out of the Christian tradition, right?
Yeah, so his big idea is really that in other societies you have tribal and clan-based and kin-based societies. I don't know what he would say about Japan. Maybe Japan is kind of a mix of Western mores and sort of older kinship-based traditions, but definitely, you know, other countries outside of the West, very traditional cultures that anthropologists study in the Amazon rainforest, for example, or in sort of the center of Africa, they tend to focus, and I think Joseph Henrich actually did field work in Papua New Guinea. So those kinds of cultures tend to focus very strongly on lineages and kin. And his big idea is that in the West, the church puts in motion this, what he calls the marriage and family program, which says to you, you're actually not allowed to do several things which help you maintain these kinship lineages. So you're not allowed to marry your cousin. It really comes down hard on certain types of marriages that you may want to pursue if you want to keep these lineages going. And because of that, it makes it very difficult to sort of think and act in this way and continue your culture in this very kinship-based way. And as a result, Western societies start to associate in a different way. Individuals start to associate with one another, not through kin primarily, but through civil associations. And then you start to get the growth of universities, and you get more pro-sociality outside of the family. So people outside the family are not seen as weird outsiders. You start to be able to collaborate with them. And then for Henrich, that gives you, or it helps you get to things like the market. Because the market depends on a certain amount of pro-sociality outside the kin. You have to be able to trust someone sufficiently to do business with them. And so all of these things he thinks come from the church's emphasis on a certain type of family structure. And ultimately, and this is a really big idea, and I'm not saying I agree with all aspects of it, ultimately thinks that even things like democracy and liberalism come from this idea that we're not just going to focus on the family, we're going to have a more universal mindset.
Yeah, it's interesting. It sort of, it opens up the society, I mean, effectively the idea of the body of Christ, the living church, whether Greek or Jew, whether free or slave, you know, everyone is in the same boat in a sense.
Exactly. So that idea in St. Paul is one that's stressed also by Tom Holland in his book Dominion about the history of Christianity. And so a lot of the new stories that scholars are telling about the West is the idea that the West is fundamentally the universalistic society. And it's a fundamentally or profoundly egalitarian society as well, actually. And so one question I have actually about these works and, you know, traveling in Japan, for example, is to what extent have these guys really done their homework not only on the Western societies, but also on non-Western societies? I think maybe Joseph Henrich has a bit more than Tom Holland, in Papua New Guinea at least. Mm. But it's interesting if you tour around the temples here, and I know this a little bit already from my experience in Buddhism, there are also in other traditions emphases on all of us being the same or all of us sharing in Buddha nature, for example. There's an egalitarianism in Buddhism as well. So then the historical question becomes, well, what was it about Buddhism and Christianity and the development which led to these more egalitarian democratic societies in the West and not so much in the East?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and he was referring to how some of the earliest Jesuit missionaries visiting places like Tibet, they were really quite shocked and fascinated by just how closely, the Buddhist worldview and a lot of the traditions of the Catholic Church in particular sort of seem to line up with some of the concepts within Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism. And I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I mean, this is, just from conversation, but it's interesting that there is similarities there, right? There's, you see things like monasteries forming, and you had monasteries, because I know you've traveled through India, right? And historically, a lot of Buddhist monasteries that were in India, which unfortunately were destroyed with the Islamic invasion of India, but you had these kind of, these places of hermitage, these places of higher learning, as you see, the kind of the Buddha nature, and kind of a tradition there that maybe in some ways at a very high level is commensurable with some of the kind of bigger themes as well of Christianity. What do you think about that?
Well, it's one of those big questions in global cultural history. When you see these similarities, and there are lots of similarities, are they a product of transmission, or are they a product of basically humans doing the same thing in different places? You know, I think we have as human beings religious inclinations, or many of us do. And so it could be that these inclinations are just going to flow into a certain shape. But it's interesting, for example, that in Islam you don't really have a monastic tradition that I know of, certainly not a strong one. In Buddhism and Christianity, they're very strong. There's even some weird examples of things like the rosary. Rosary beads, like saying a prayer on each bead. And that's also something that you see in Buddhist traditions. So what were the rosary beads? Some people actually have studied this and think that they were transmitted along with the idea of these, or maybe even physical examples, were transmitted along the Silk Route. And others say, no, it's just something that, you know, both traditions came to independently.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to the sort of social organization of it, I mean, this has been a topic, I mean, you and I have been talking about over the last few days, been thinking a lot about that, kind of what is underpinning Japan, right? What is the sort of the social fabric of it? And I mean, it does feel to me, I mean, it is an incredibly secular place. It's a very materialistic place, and this is the laments of many many authors who maybe were operating in the earlier 20th century. There was a massive change with the end of the war, and kind of the removal of this centrality of spirit and the Japanese way to everyday life, right? You know, that kind of got swapped out with consumer culture. And it's very interesting, as I mentioned just the other day, I was visiting a temple around here, Kenchoji, and everyone just visiting on their phones, just kind of as tourists, as kind of onlookers to this beautiful 750-year-old temple. And it really just sort of struck me that it was sort of like a Disneyland type experience. And no doubt you get that. I know I've been to Strasbourg, I've different places where, you know, people line up to visit the cathedrals and take photos. And I mean, that's maybe it's a human thing, it's a tourist thing. But I've always found that very interesting, this kind of the praxis of religion versus the doxology, I believe we were talking about this the other day, whether it's whether you believe it or whether you're just sort of performing the actions of the religion.
Yeah, I think I was talking about this distinction between orthopraxic religions and orthodoxic religions.
Yes.
Orthodoxic religions, I think I'm getting the term right, are religions where you're supposed to believe in a certain way. So that means, orthodoxy means right opinion. I mean, literally, the etymology, at least from Greek, is it means right opinion. And orthopraxy would be something like right behavior. So in the ancient Greco-Roman world, one of the things that really pissed off a lot of pagans about Christianity and Judaism, actually, was this idea that there's only one God and it's a jealous God, or he's a jealous God. And so you're not really supposed to worship idols, right? And you're not supposed to sacrifice to other gods. And, you know, people who do sacrifice to other gods in the Old Testament get into big trouble with true God, right? And so in the Greco-Roman Empire, the Roman Empire, which had a large Greek element, they really practiced this thing called Interpretatio Romana, which is a very simple, kind of quite liberal practice where you go to a different part of the empire, say Egypt, and they're worshiping this god called Ammon. And you think, well, who is Ammon? And they say, oh, he's a sky god. He throws thunder. And you think, okay, that's Zeus. So then what you do is you just worship, you sacrifice to Ammon in the shape of Zeus. So you think of it as Zeus, they think of it as Ammon. And sometimes you even have these hyphenated gods, Zeus, Ammon, right? Now, you try and do that with Judaism, it doesn't go down very well. This is one of the things that sparked one of the Jewish revolts against the Roman Empire, actually, is that the Romans were saying, put a statue of the emperor in your temple courtyard. What's wrong with that? Just pay cult to the emperor. And the Jews were like, no, we don't have a statue of the emperor in our temple courtyard. And the whole thing kicked off, of course, and the Jews obviously, you know, kept getting crushed by the Roman Empire. But that was one of the things also which was got Christians into deep trouble and meant that there was always going to be a deep cleft between the pagan world and the Christian one. It couldn't just be accommodated into paganism.
Yeah, this was something I was thinking about just again yesterday. Did a midweek Eucharist service at an Anglican church in Tokyo, and then after that went and visited a Buddhist temple, Pure Land, Zenzoji, and very interesting because inside the main hall there's, you know, a statue of Buddha, and then there's also a statue of Tokugawa Ieyasu, who was one of the Edo Edo period leaders, the key people of the time. And I think there was also a couple of statues of various leaders, thought leaders within the spiritual tradition. So you had these kind of pantheon, I guess you could say, of statues and idols and all sorts of shiny objects and things with the incense and this image of this temple, and then the line for the gifts that you could buy, because they had all sorts of incense for sale, and so you could hear the chanting of the monks and then the beep beep of people paying with their credit cards and the cashiers and doing the transactions, and this just interesting kind of relationship between money and faith. It was a really interesting observation. And what's been your experience? You've been exploring some of the temples around here.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Zenkoji in Nagano, which was a beautiful experience, actually, because it was snowing at the time, so very aesthetically pleasing, but also very spiritually and religiously interesting, because I went to the early morning service and they were chanting and the monks came by and they were blessing the pilgrims, which is supposed to be an ancient ceremony, probably is, with their beads. And then the tour guide told us later they were doing a special ceremony later, and he said, oh, that's a special ceremony for a family who's paid a lot of money for it, and if you would like to get a ceremony, you just come to the temple and pay lots of money.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. But I will say, I mean, sometimes you have this experience with Christian churches as well, right? Tends to be the big ones. And maybe we're also slightly biased because we tend to visit the Buddhist temples that are more touristy. But like if you go to St. Paul's or, I don't know, the Vatican, St. Peter's, there probably is a cafe and a gift. Like increasingly there are cafes and gift shops in these places. And they need to make money not only to sort of keep the churches going in terms of institutions, but also to fix the leaking roof and things like that. So both of these traditions do need money. It's just a question of how they collect it. And, you know, in the old days, people used to tithe in Christianity. I don't know how many people do that nowadays. And there's always the collection that they're handing around, right? You have to put coins into the hat. So they both have those pressures.
That's interesting, though. This particular example, just the proximity of the line for the gift queue and the the actual monk, you know, doing his thing with a family. I think there was perhaps a bereavement. You know, it was actually a ceremony taking place. It was right there, a few meters apart. You know?
Yeah,
and that was just really interesting to me.
Let me pick up on something else you were saying before. So I also think it's super interesting how when you go into a Buddhist monastery or a Buddhist temple, you do often have these figures like an emperor from the past. Or, I mean, we were talking about this the other day too. So during the Meiji Restoration, you know more about this than me, there was actually a law, I think, or a decision made by the government to separate Shinto shrines and Buddhist temples when before they'd been all mixed up. And you can still see a little bit of that mixing up. So you're right that you go into a Buddhist temple and you see cults to other people or other figures. Again, you do see something similar sometimes in Christian churches in the sense that you'll have the main altar, which is obviously about the Eucharist and about Jesus. You'll have lots of maybe Jesus-related stuff like Stations of the Cross. But, you know, in a Catholic church, you might have a statue of Mary, and the larger Catholic cathedrals in Europe, they'll have side chapels devoted to individual saints, maybe a local saint. They're not from a different tradition. I think what's more interesting here is that you get sort of Shinto and Buddhism, so local kami or spirits mixed up with Buddhism. And that's kind of interesting to me how I think Westerners often come to Buddhism with this mindset that it's just sort of a rational religion, and it's obviously not. There's lots of kind of very strongly religious activity bound up with it. But there does seem to be a little bit more room for other things to go on because there's not such a strong emphasis on this. Really, this is ultimately a Jewish bit of the Judeo-Christian tradition, I think. There's emphasis on the jealous God, that the God doesn't want, you know, thou shalt not worship other idols or set up idols. I can't remember the Ten Commandments. But yeah. So, but it doesn't quite say that, I don't think, at any point in the sutras. And you don't really worship the Buddha in quite the same sense, right? Because even though the Buddha is often said to have supernatural powers in stories, ultimately the Buddha is not a god, right?
You'd be surprised though, because are you familiar with the difference with the Tariki and the Jidiki traditions?
Is that no, let me.
Okay, so you're very interested. You've experienced Zen. You're really interested in Zen. And Zen really is what you would call the Jidiki tradition, which is where you attempt to achieve enlightenment for yourself. And so this is through deep meditation, through a reflection on your attachment to the world, etc. And the Zen tradition sees this as, through meditation, whereas the Tariki, which literally means someone else, and Riki is power, so it's for someone else, whereas Jidiki is for the self, Ji means the self. Tariki is the opposite, which is where you have something like the statue of the Buddha interceding for you. This is this has been done, this is the pathway, and you kind of, it has been done for you. And so the Pure Land Buddhist sect in Japan is very much in that vein. It's you have the statue, you pray to the statue, the Buddha is gracious, and the Buddha is providing that for you. And so that is quite a distinction, I think. And again, I'm not expert on this, but certainly within Japan, Zen being the clearest example, that Tariki tradition, it's very much an ascetic tradition.
Yeah.
If that sort of makes sense. And so a lot of the major players, like the Pure Land Buddhism, I think they have that kind of, it's going to be done for you. And you have monks praying for the people and kind of trying to bring it. They stay behind. They don't achieve enlightenment for themselves. They stay behind to pray and to kind of bestow that upon others, in a sense.
That's right. So that's a temple of Zenkoji in Nagano. That's a Shin Pure Land tradition temple. And they have a mantra, Namu Amida Butsu, which I think is common to a lot of the Shin schools. And I think it's known as Nembutsu as well. I've seen that term.
Yeah.
And they recite this, and the idea is that you accumulate merit. And I think in some of those schools, you recite the mantra in order to get to the Pure Land, which is heaven. In other of those schools, you recite the mantra as gratitude because you've already been granted a place in the Pure Land. So it's kind of this weird sort of Calvinist thing where it's already foreordained who's going to the Pure Land. So you better recite the mantra because that's kind of a clue that you are one of the chosen.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's very different to the idea that Westerners usually have of Buddhism, including myself, right? And there can sometimes be this disappointment. It's like, oh, I thought everything here was all rational. Everyone's doing meditation. And even in the Zen temples, I get the idea, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that in a lot of Eastern countries, this is definitely the case in Thailand, it's probably the case in Japan as well, it's really the monks who do meditation. I think I've seen increasingly in some of these temples, they have little spots set aside for visitors to do zazen. But I think traditionally, it's really monks who do meditation. and lay people doing meditation isn't so much of a thing. And it's interesting, I think that's something that the Western Buddhists are kind of contributing to Buddhism, the strong emphasis on sitting yourself. And so Shinryu Suzuki, who was a monk who trained in Eheiji, where I was the other day, near Fukui, and he came to California in the 70s or 60s, I think, and he started practicing. He actually went there to be a priest for the local Japanese emigre community. And then there were all these hippies who went to him and said, "We want to do meditation. Can you teach us to do meditation?" And he was really impressed because, you know, the Japanese emigre community were just wanting him to do ceremonies for pay, right? And he thought, this is great. And he sort of founded the San Francisco Zen Center, and that became a place where lay people would come and do meditation.
That's fascinating. And this idea that, you know, maybe in a sense, this emergence of like California Buddhism, as kind of we could call it, it's almost taking some of these Christian ideas of faith and sola fide, right? You must have faith alone. And so you really believe it. It's not the performative pay as you go that I saw the other day. You know, we're having there's maybe a bereavement, and of course we will pay for a small ceremony that we may or may not believe. There's a sort of inconsequential. And in a sense, I wonder whether maybe you see any connection there between that very deep Protestant idea of faith as being then applied kind of latently, not being utilized by Protestantism in, say, the Western US in the same degree, then kind of being applied during the kind of the hippie movement towards something like Buddhism.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of California Buddhists wouldn't say they believe in the Buddhist scriptures or the traditional story of the Buddha's life, for example, literally. So they're maybe doing something orthopraxic to an extent, although it's a bit different. I think with the classic idea of orthopraxy is more you perform a sacrifice or something and that's all the god cares about. Whereas with Western Buddhism, it's really, the emphasis is on the experience of meditation and also the idea that you progress in meditation and you get to be a better person. I mean, of course, in the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, that's also emphasized. I thought you were going to talk before about the distinction between the sort of Theravada emphasis on you're becoming enlightened for yourself and the Mahayana emphasis on you're getting enlightened for yourself but also to save other beings, which you also see in Zen.
That might be connected, actually. That might be the distinction. I'm not sure the exact translation of it, but that possibly relates to the Tariki and the Jidiki situation.
Yeah. Let me say one more thing. Yeah. Maybe you're going to transition into this anyway, but I think it's super interesting that now Christianity also has its mystical traditions and its mystical history. And so it's really interesting. Like, I went to Thailand once to this temple, and I was talking to a young woman there, and she was saying, "Oh, you meditate?" And she was a Buddhist. And I said, "Yeah, I meditate." She said, "How much do you meditate?" And I said, "Well, I try and do it every day." And her eyes sort of lit up. She was like, "Wow," you know. And she kind of looked at me like I was some kind of saint or something, which I'd like to assure everybody I'm very much not. But it's kind of, I was trying to think, what must that have been like for her? And I think it's kind of like if you met someone from Japan who converted to Christianity and he came to Europe and he was like, "Oh, I do like Ignatius Loyola's spiritual exercises every week."
Yeah.
We would think, "Oh my God, this guy's like super hardcore," right? Because I think in the West too, there are these spiritual exercises, but they're really traditionally done by people who've devoted their whole lives, like, you know, monks and friars and so on and so forth. So I think there's a huge opportunity for Christianity, which I'm starting to see them take advantage of now, to say, "Well, we have our mystical traditions too. All you people who are leaving Christianity to go practice Buddhist-style meditation or Hindu-style meditation, come back to churches. We can give you some good, spiritual exercises."
Well, I mean, even just as I said yesterday, this midweek Eucharist service, I mean, that was a pretty profound experience. It was English, but ad orientem, so the pastor facing away and facing towards the cross, facing away from the people, and very much a high church tradition with incense and a lightly sung prayers and a very somber, beautiful experience. And I thought that, you know, that was a profound experience. And I mean, certainly many people maybe who grew up in the Catholic tradition will be familiar with this, but you know, this is an Anglican church. You know, this is Protestantism, and it's like we still have that stuff available, right?
I think High Church Anglicanism is the closest you get to Catholicism within the Protestant tradition. And there's no doubt, I mean, it's really beautiful. I mean, when I was studying at Oxford, I knew some people who swam the Tiber, as they used to say, and converted to the Roman Church. And at Oxford, there's a very aesthetic emphasis. I mean, a lot of these people, I don't want to sort of doubt their sincerity, but I think in large part it was because of the beauty of the high Anglican Mass, well, almost like a Catholic Mass.
Well, you had the Oxford movement.
That's right, yeah.
John Henry Newman, that was probably the most famous example, started off Anglican, made his way all the way across, as you say. And I mean, you're probably more schooled in the history of that, but that was like, what, 19th century, maybe at a time when maybe there was different sort of thoughts on where the Anglican Church was going after a couple of hundred years, right?
Yeah. And there's always been different traditions within the Anglican Church, low church, high church, charismatic. Okay, I think there's a couple of other ones as well, but because it was a national church and has been for hundreds of years, they kind of have to accommodate different strands. And some Anglicans I know say that this is a good feature of the Anglican Church, that it's so theologically confused, because it has to be kind of liberal and broad church.
Yeah.
But interestingly, we talk about these forms of the Catholic Mass where the priest faces away from the congregation. In Nagano at Zenkoji, it was so similar, the ceremony that they were doing. They had these guys who were, I imagine, some kinds of Buddhist priests, and they were also facing the altar away from the congregation, I guess you could call it. And there were other monks there chanting. And the way that the other monks were arranged, it was a lot like a choir in an Anglican church that I've seen, or a Catholic church. And so, again, you have that question. Is this because there was some transmission of traditions between Europe and the East in the Middle Ages or the Renaissance? Or is it just because humans have these inclinations, and when they do religious ceremonies, they end up doing similar things?
What's interesting, you mentioned that. I've been reflecting on this a lot. You know, what is the default state? And I think, generally speaking, you know, most people who look at this closely see, you know, in the Nietzschean sense, the God-shaped hole is very much real, and we you could argue that we're designed to worship, and that is a core substrate of just everything about humanity. And this maybe tends to manifest in certain ways, which, if we were to compare it with, say, other animals, we see nothing of the like. And so it's very much a trait of human societies. And one of the examples that really stands out to me is the traditions of the Americas pre-contact, and just the sun gods that they had, and the relationship to sort of blood sacrifice, these kinds of things. It's very interesting to see that connection there, which is, you know, I mean, maybe that originally came from the same proto situation that all of these places came from.
Yeah, those guys took it quite far, though. They had human sacrifices.
And I mean, I found that very quite challenging to sort of integrate and to think about, I found it challenging to think about the, what was La Donna Bella? La Donna, there's this famous example. It's like a 15-year-old girl that they found at the top of a hill that got left, top of a mountain, that got left behind as like a human sacrifice. So, I mean, you got this kind of history.
In Mexico?
This was in Chile, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, man,
I can't keep talking. The religious theme is so interesting to me. Let me just say, I actually have a theory. Someone probably has said this before at greater length and more detail, but you say the animals don't display worship, and I agree they don't have religions in any ordinary sense, but I sometimes think that a lot of the things that we do in human religions have to do with dominance hierarchies, because one other very striking similarity between Buddhist and Christian practice is some of the postures and gestures. And that's something that's also very emphasized in Zen Buddhism, that you're trained to put your hands in certain shapes and to bow in certain ways. And obviously bowing is bigger in the East than it is in the West. But it's really a gesture of submission. And, you know, a lot of Buddhist traditions also ask you to fully prostrate yourself, which is definitely a gesture of submission. And I think this inclination we have towards worship is something that makes us feel safe, helps us feel safe and secure, because the idea is you have like a top dog who is mightier than you, who's going to lead you. And it's not just, you know, humans can actually use their imagination or maybe tap into something real, however we want to look at it. And it's not just that, like, this is the biggest wolf who's going to lead your wolf pack. It's like, this is an omniscient creator. And if you submit yourself to that, you feel like you're in a natural order, and that makes you feel safe and protected. Because religious practice seems to be related as well in most human cultures, at least modern ones, with reductions in anxiety. People turn to religious practice often when they're in trouble in their life, and they seem to feel that it soothes them. I've certainly found this.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, you know, we're musing on this role of religion, but I look at the most recent census in New Zealand, which has found that the proportion of people with no religion has increased from 48.2% in 2018 to 51.6% in 2023. So this is over 2.5 million people in New Zealand identifying as having no religion. And I just wonder, put that statement alone, I mean, what do you make of that? How do you sort of begin to look at that?
Okay, I mean, I think that New Zealand is a fundamentally secular society, one of the most secular in the world, and you often meet people who I think seem to have no religious education whatsoever. Some people, I do think there are a minority of people who just have no religious inclination whatsoever, but I actually think there are a lot more who, it's almost a danger, because I think people are gonna get drawn into cults because they have no kind of awareness of religious traditions, not even Christianity. So I think that's not a great thing. But one of my colleagues at the New Zealand Initiative, Benno Blaschke, you should probably talk to at some point, he actually has a PhD in, I can't remember what actual field it was in, but he looked into mysticism, like Buddhist meditation. And he thinks that those figures are slightly deceptive because you do have fewer people going to traditional church services and engaging in traditional religion. But if you ask them other questions, like do you have a spiritual aspect to your life, apparently a lot more people say yes to that. So it seems like people are still quite spiritual and they still have these inclinations that we're talking about, but for whatever reason, they don't identify with conventional religions. And foremost, you know, first and foremost in New Zealand, I think what they hear when people are asking, are you religious? They think they're asking, are you a church-going Christian? And so a lot fewer people are doing that, but it doesn't mean they're not religiously interested.
Well, it's interesting though, because as you say, that
or spiritually interested.
Well, it opens up problematic situations, right, where that God-shaped hole can get filled with things like bona fide cults, or other things.
Yeah, or like wokeness at the universities. A lot of people have commented on similarities between that and religion.
And there's kind of artifacts. You mentioned the hierarchies of dominance. These kind of perversions of maybe say some of the Christian ideals and worldview, but through something like the woke movement, the idea of the victim. You know, there's a lot of quite kind of metaphysical concepts within that. Like what does it mean to be a victim? What does it mean to be oppressed? You know, there's a lot of big questions there that I guess are, in a sense, you know, they're not seeking out a practical answer. You know, these aren't necessarily just problems to be solved. They're always everywhere. And in a sense, they're a very Marxist idea that there is an oppressor and an oppressed.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Holland at the end of Dominion actually has a chapter on woke. It's really interesting, in which he sort of presents it as a souped up and maybe distorted version of Christianity. Another element that he stresses is Puritanism. So you get this sort of hyperbolic emphasis on sexual purity, essentially. The victim complex as well as part of that. Really strong emphasis on kindness, almost to the expense of all else, which arguably, you know, Christianity is pointing in that direction, but doesn't go quite as far or as crazy with it. So, and I think just generally a kind of religious way of looking at things, like a very religious mindset with woke, that they have this idea of sacred things, sacred ideas, even sort of sacred groups of people. You're not meant to criticize, otherwise you're in trouble, you could lose your job. All those things make it almost like a state religion now in a very strange way.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I would say, I mean, certainly it is very different, I think, to Christianity in many ways. It's almost more paganistic, though, because you get these different kinds of victims. You've got the oppressed minority who's for their sexuality, and then the oppressed minority because of their race, and there's different kinds of, you know, altars at which you can worship depending on the day of the week kind of thing. And that's really interesting. And then the person themselves, the people themselves aren't even people in that sense. You know, they become objects, they become idols. And so the idea of a, you know, the disabled black transgender person of color, you know,
that's true. I mean, there's not so much an emphasis on the individual soul or the individual as there is on the individual as a representative of a group, because that's often the thing that really matters. It's like, even you're not allowed to make certain points, even theoretically, unless you're part of a certain group, right?
Yeah, and I was reading a book, the What's Our Problem, which sort of talks about this in a kind of a funny way, and it starts off with some quite interesting critiques of the right, but then it sort of does the same for the left. And I mean, the book itself seems to be written from a leftist perspective, but the critiques of the left are about two-thirds of the book, you know, which is that, yeah, you can't actually make they don't let you make a critique unless you're part of that tribe. And then even within that, if you're seen as making a critique and you're part of that tribe, and then you're sort of seen as, well, you're a dissenter, you're a heretic, if you happen to be of that oppressed class.
So to me, that's reminiscent of wars of religion in, you know, the history of Europe, even though we should point out it's not as bad, right? People aren't literally being burned at the stake, but they are having their careers ruined.
And well, you got kicked out of
I got kicked out of Vic, yeah.
So, sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean,
But, you know, it's very interesting, because I think people get this wrong. They say, oh, you know, there's a problem at universities affecting right-wingers, and the right-wingers are complaining because they can't speak. And it's like, yes, that's true, and that is actually, by the way, a valid concern. You should be able to speak your mind if you're a conservative at universities, because there are lots of conservatives in society as a whole. But it's actually even worse and crazier than people think. It's, you're not allowed to speak your mind on certain topics unless you're a certain type of extreme leftist. Right, because one of the big blow-ups has been between the trans rights types, or certain types of trans rights types, and so-called TERFs, right, trans-exclusionary radical feminists. And all of those people are on the left. In fact, all of those people are really on the quite far left. Like, some of those radical feminists are extremely radical, extremely radical in their feminism. And they're getting canceled, even though they're far left in every other way.
So that's interesting. And I mean, what's your take? I mean, it's been a few years since you've been in academia, but you're... I mean, what was some of the craziest stuff you saw in your time with this high, you know, peak wokeness?
Well, I mean, I think it was a lot of it was stuff I saw in other places. Like, one of them that springs to mind is the guy who was teaching Chinese, and he said this word which sounds like, you know, a big ethnic slur in the U.S. And I don't think he was actually fired, but he was disciplined. And that one was just completely insane. But I definitely got into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I mean. I tell the story a lot, but I was lecturing once about Alexander the Great, and I said Alexander the Great created this huge empire, but he didn't really have a nominated successor. One of his successors was Philip Aridaeus, who was his half-brother, and I said something like Philip Aridaeus couldn't succeed to the throne because he was a bit special. And in the textbook, the textbook was written in the 90s, and it said, Philip Aridaeus could not succeed to the throne as he was retarded. Which makes us laugh nowadays because it's kind of like a bad word. But it was used quite commonly in the 90s. So the student sent me this huge long email about how it's a slur word and she was offended and we had to withdraw the textbook. So I sent her back a few articles from the 90s, scientific articles, which used the word as a scientific term. And I said, you got to just appreciate this fact that was actually a technical term. It's not a slur word. It's a huge email back. It is a slur word, I know, because I've been diagnosed with ADHD. And of course, the powers that be at the university, the head of school at the time, put me through like a couple of two or three meetings about it, asked me to change my language. Of course, I refused. So the university is just, you know, the head of school in that case, and Vic in general, should have done its duty and actually defended free speech and defended rational inquiry and stood up to the student in that case. I mean, admittedly, they didn't withdraw the textbook that had asked me to do that. But they, you know, they regularly have failed in this, and by doing that, they've just sort of made the problem worse.
What do you think the future holds for New Zealand if we see a continuation of this trend of no religion, of less of a formal structure around religion, perhaps still some spiritual components within people's lives, but certainly people not identifying as any kind of religious adherent? What do you think that means for New Zealand long term?
I don't know, man. I actually think that New Zealand is probably somewhat similar to other Western countries in this. I think it's a little bit more advanced. I think that's one of the interesting things about New Zealand. In some ways, New Zealand has always been very backward, and it still is. In some ways, it's kind of at the cutting edge. Because in some ways, like Canada, it's a particularly ideological and pure version of the sort of weird way of life. It often does things ahead of the curve. So I'm reading a lot at the moment about the introduction of universal democracy, universal voting, universal manhood franchise, and then also female voting in New Zealand at the national level for the first time anywhere in the world. So those things happened first in New Zealand. Well, actually, some of these things, like secret ballot, happened first in Australia, but Australia and New Zealand are kind of similar in this regard. So I think with spirituality, what we're going to see in the West, maybe increasingly in the East as well, I actually think we're going to see more and more of an evolution towards spiritualism, some kind of syncretic faith. And I think New Zealand is going to be the cutting edge of that, where people are increasingly spiritual but not religious. Now, I should mention that I have this conversation with people who are more sort of full-blooded Christians all the time, and they laugh at me, because so far the evidence has been, if you look at the churches like the official Anglican Church, which have gone more sort of spiritual but not religious and more liberal, sometimes even a bit woke, they've lost adherence. And the real action in Christianity at the moment seems to be with sort of more full-blooded revivalist churches that do believe in the literal truth of the Bible and so on and so forth. So I may be wrong about this, but I think especially in New Zealand, I think in the States there's different dynamics going on. I think in New Zealand, because it's so sort of weird in a left-wing direction, I think that we're going to get more and more spiritual but not religious, and somehow the remaining Christian churches are going to be drawn into that, and it's going to kind of mingle with Buddhism in some way.
Can you put a value judgment on that in terms of whether that is a good thing or whether that is a dangerous pathway?
I actually think that's the way forward. I know you probably don't. I know others don't. But I think that's the way forward, because I don't actually literally believe in the truth of the traditional Buddhist stories or the traditional Christian stories. But I think there's immense value in both of those traditions and in religious, even religious, not just spiritual traditions. So I hope that I think that people will continue to be inclined towards religious and spiritual practice and experience. And I hope that that can keep being a thing, because as you say, if we don't do it sort of consciously and you don't participate in it actively, there's always the risk that it kind of runs up and gets you, and then you're doing some weird stuff. You're being woke and you're canceling people or whatever it is. You don't even know what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean,
Or the other thing at the moment, I should say, for balance, but also because it's true, you become some kind of alt-right weirdo, and you have religious inclinations in that direction. You're canceling people for not being far right enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's still sitting within the political realm, though. I mean, I guess maybe this is me reflecting on the move towards this kind of spiritualism. You know, I mean, there's certainly a darkness to that. You know, that a spiritual darkness, I guess you could say, the anything goes. You know, I think of a lot of the burner culture, the kind of, it's to a degree sort of a hippie culture as well. You know, it's kind of like, well, just whatever feels good, whatever is right for you in that moment. And it's very kind of ambiguous.
Yeah. So that's another really interesting thing that's happened with religion and spirituality in the past few decades. And this is especially sharp when you look at, so I told that story before of Shinri Suzuki coming to the West and founding the San Francisco Zen Center. Now, I've hung out with, like California Buddhists in California and hippies in other countries, or people from the sort of hippie generation. And it's super interesting to me how they are sort of morally, in terms of mores and norms. They're almost always kind of proponents of free love. I mean, they might not constantly be having sex. I mean, many of them are quite elderly at this point, and I don't think they're having like multiple partners and stuff. But like their inclination is basically like, do whatever you want, man. You know, they're often, they take an extremely liberal interpretation of traditional Buddhist bans on intoxicants. So they're often like quite pro-psychedelics. So basically what I'm trying to say is, the spiritual but not religious people, one of the things that often means is spiritual practice in terms of mysticism and maybe in terms of community, but very little emphasis on morality. In fact, often like a reflexive dislike of any kind of moral code. And that, I mean, I think people should be able to do what they want, but just as a historian, that's very much not what traditional Buddhism is, right? Traditional Buddhism, I mean, look at Theravada Buddhism, Eightfold Path, you know, a lot of it is about morality. That's really the part of the path to the contented life is morality. So, yeah, I think they're missing something. Whether this is an evolution, I mean, I think that I should say as well, I mean, most of those people, I don't think, have done terribly evil things. It's really more liberalism around sort of individual drug use and maybe love in a consensual sense, but or sex in a consensual sense. But yeah, I think it's a little bit hypocritical in some cases that they say we're Buddhists, or even we're practitioners of certain types of Hinduism, but they very conveniently throw out anything that they actually don't really want to do.
Yeah, I mean, you say there's nothing that's really evil about it, but I mean, what is evil?
Oh, well, I mean, evil for me is things like Hitler. Like, that's the easiest example. But like, killing people is evil, right? Like, I would say, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say if you want to go take LSD, I wouldn't. I might say, be careful. I wouldn't necessarily say that's evil.
I just wonder though, that this anything goes idea. I mean, for me, the more I look at this, I think that is actually incredibly challenging to everything we've just talked about, the history of the West, this privileged position we're in, where we have functioning societies and systems that work, is predicated fundamentally on law and structure. And from where did we get the law? Of course, from Moses, you know.
No, you think that's silly. I mean, it's not silly. It's, like, this is the thing. This is basically Henrik. This is the view of the West, that because we had a certain religion and certain morals, we had certain family structure. And so monogamy, for example, that's a classic thing where maybe not even the hippie generation, because they were still too close to Christianity. But now, I've written an article about this for Quillette. Now it's getting a bit more fashionable among Western elites to be polyamorous, right? To have multiple partners, or at least to be open to that. And I'm a liberal. Like, if people want to do things like that, they can do that if they're all consenting adults. But I think we're playing a risk. We're risking something here in terms of society as a whole, because if Henrik's right and other people are right about how the West developed, monogamy was one of the crucial pieces that made us great, in a sense, because monogamy is very egalitarian. Because in a polygamous society, and it's usually polygynous, it's usually sort of men having multiple wives, what happens is you get the big guys at the top, the big men at the top, who have lots of wives. And in Islam, you're allowed up to four, right? So maybe you have like the top 10% of men have up to four wives. And then people in the middle maybe have one wife each because they can't afford more. And then the guys at the bottom don't have any wives. And now that's a problem for society, for the social stability of the society, because you have all these guys who are sexually frustrated. If you get married and become a father, your testosterone actually goes down. So in some ways, I mean, the alt-right people say we need to go back to the West when we were strong and manly. Actually, there's an argument that Greece and Rome, for example, were like extraordinarily low-T societies. And the Roman Empire managed to conquer so much territory, not because they were all manly men, but because they were actually unusually cooperative with each other, because they were locked into this monogamous system. So I'm not saying like Western civ is definitely going to collapse if more people become polygamous or polyamorous, but I do think we're actually, you know, we're sort of playing with fire a little bit. We don't know what's going
to
happen.
You know, maybe we need some more epistles to come out and just remind people that, you know, there's a reason for this.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the traditional Christian view. And I think that one of the problems is that people won't necessarily go along with that anymore if you're just going to say, Paul said this. But we might be able to convince people that there are reasons for kind of not going too crazy on the polyamory front, which are kind of more consequentialist. So, you know, it's still going to be difficult because the high status men are always going to want to have multiple ladies. And a lot of ladies, because now there's feminism as well, and I agree with this aspect of feminism, like we think women should be able to do what they want. And actually, I think some ladies would prefer to be the third girlfriend of Brad Pitt than to be the only girlfriend of some guy who's homeless, right?
Yeah.
That's also female human nature. Yeah. So yeah, it's just to say, it's going to be really interesting what happens from here on in, because I think the rise of the West, a lot of historical evidence now that it was really predicated on Christian morals played a huge role in that. And now we're going to try and say, we're going to have the advanced West, but we're not going to do Christianity anymore. And again, it may be that we've just reached a level of technological development, for example, where we're going to be fine and it's not going to matter. But I do think it's a little bit of a risk.
The more I spend time thinking about this, James, though, I do think all of these material things we have, they're predicated on incredibly fragile systems in terms of supply chains and political stability. And we're at the very top of things like the internet and the electricity working. I know that sounds pretty fundamental, but in a lot of places those don't work very well because they require people to maintain them and people to turn up and repair them and to be responsible. And it doesn't take much, but maybe a few generations or so to undermine that. And I do sometimes wonder, is that in particular the West, which has gone through this long period of kind of rejecting its roots, if we're sort of beginning to distance ourselves from, we're still within the realm that we could maybe pull it back, but I don't know. I sometimes think, man, are we...
Yeah, we'll see. I think if we do see things starting to fray, this theory I had was correct, that it's a risk because of monogamous norms eroding. What we'll start to see is sort of incel culture, which we are starting to see, and that becoming like a major problem. like maybe a lot of single male mass shooters or things like that. There are, of course, single male mass shooters, including in New Zealand, Brendan Tarrant, for example, but I don't think that was an incel thing. That was more of a white supremacist thing. So anyway, so we'll see what happens. One thing I'll say, actually, interestingly, one of the really interesting things about being in Japan and thinking about these issues is that what you have in Japan, as every visitor will notice, is like an extremely orderly, functional, high-tech Western, non-Western society, right? So, of course, the Meiji Restoration was this moment when Japan basically decided to adopt a lot of the mores and a lot of the technology of the West. But, you know, different observers disagree on this, but a lot of people say it's still fundamentally Japanese, right? So that's a big historical question itself, like, why is it that Japan managed so long before other Eastern societies to kind of westernize itself successfully, even though it didn't really have Christianity, you know, it banned Christianity to a certain point, so Christianity was never like a major influence. So how did it do that? What were the cultural influences here that made it different from places like China that struggled to westernize for such a long time?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. Why? Is it a case that they kind of imported the mold of society without the original object that created that mold? And you know, you had this rapid development in the Meiji period to build Japan up into what it was, but without maybe that kind of underpinning structure of why are we doing this. And you maybe you have the aspect of performance there, like we'll just, you know, monkey see, monkey do. But who knows?
Felipe Fernandez Armesto, this historian, I think in his book Civilizations, he has a story about, I can't remember who this is at all, but it's a Westerner and a Japanese guy in like the, I don't know, 1920s or something. And the Japanese guy says to him, this is our plan, we're going to adopt everything that the West did and everything that made the West great, except for one thing that we're going to keep in our culture, and that's reverence for the ancestors. And this historian was basically saying, that's what the Japanese thought they could do, but actually that's the one thing you kind of need, is reverence for the ancestors, but in the West we've been good at also moving away from tradition and innovating. And so then you can tell a story about how even though Japan was very technologically advanced in World War II, for example, did bloody well considering the size of the population and stuff, they ultimately failed because they didn't have the kind of ingenuity and the individualism of the United States. I got Victor Davis Hanson also, that book Carnage and Culture, he has a whole chapter on Midway, and he talks about how, you know, Japanese had the best technology, had much better planes, even their aircraft carriers were better, but they weren't thinking in an individualistic way, they still were very top down. And I don't know if that's also the reason why the Japanese economy stalled, but people do say that, right, that the Americans are very good innovators, the Japanese are very good at doing like really good versions of what the Americans have invented like 5 years ago.
Right? Yeah. It's all very fascinating, man. We've gone down some rabbit holes.
You probably have like 17 other things.
No. I mean, this is good stuff. What's next for you though, man? You're here for a little bit. Where are you off to next?
I'm actually off to Istanbul to do more traveling because I had a pretty big year, I guess. The last few years have been pretty big for me, for various reasons. So I'm going to have a bit of a holiday and then I'm going to go to England and try and get a job there. And if not, I'm going to travel the world as a vagabond and maybe a holy man.
I think that sounds...
See who follows me.
The latter option sounds quite interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people have really long mustaches, really long beards, like holy men. I'm going to go for like a really long mustache and see if that gets me anywhere.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's lovely to be here and great to do this episode with you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.